to New Realities Television and Radio here on bbsradio.com. New Realities is produced by me, Alan Steinfeld, and each week I explore evolving human potentials in an evolving world. This series investigates how to become more conscious beings, how to live in a more conscious reality, and how we can evolve to our body, mind, and spirit. Tonight, a very interesting guest, someone who's explored lots of possibilities in consciousness and psychology, and we're going to talk about his spiritual journey and what his understanding of psychology and spirit, really, and then how that all comes together. His name is Dr. Mike Larkin, and he is a clinical psychologist, and he's from England, so I think we'll have a really interesting show. Hi, Mike, welcome.
Hi there.
Let me say that, we've both been on a spiritual journey. How do you think spirit and psychology, because that's your background, how do the two really come together, in your opinion? Spirituality, the search for who we are, and the understanding of the human mind.
Well, I think it comes together by how we actually connect with people. And I've learned through spirituality that the best way to connect with people is through the heart. Before that, my psychology training led me to think that the way to help people was to come from the mind. And as that's combined with spirituality, I've got a different perspective on things now.
Do you think psychology is changing all around, or are there still people caught in the old? I mean, it seems like there are people caught in the old school, so.
Yeah, there's a bit of both. I mean, some people seem to be caught in the old school, and I meet people who are more open and more connected with spirituality.
I mean, there's so many, though, really classical psychologists that would say this belief in spirituality is sort of a wishful thinking, and there really only is the mind. I don't know how to talk to those people, because obviously you need to have an experience in order to have the understanding. So what do you say to your colleagues?
Well, I don't have a great deal of conversation with colleagues that aren't into spirituality, and my advice to anybody going to see a psychologist or a psychiatrist would be to feel them out and not go to them if you can't feel a good connection.
So do you want to talk about your spiritual journey? Because obviously, I don't know that much about you, but you probably come from that sort of mind school. So what happened?
Well, my journey, spiritual journey, sort of began about 3 years ago. And before then, as you said, I mean, I was very much studying and coming from the mind, and interested in different therapies, and I attended therapy groups. So I was interested in personal development too. And then I came across somebody called Paul Lowe and heard him speak and was immediately attracted to him. And I've done lots of workshops with him, and everything, you know, was new to me. I didn't really have any spiritual background, so I went into it as a psychologist, as someone interested in personal development, and he totally transformed my life by how I now think about things.
Well, yeah, no, Paul's been a great guest on this show as well, and he's someone who's influenced my thinking, and in the sense of how to drop into a deeper connection to myself. And it seems like even in Paul's philosophy and the way he works with people, he includes psychology, but he doesn't limit who we are to just psychological mechanisms.
Absolutely, and I think what I learned from Paul, it totally changed how I work with people. Before Paul, I would be in my head with people. I'd be using my brain to think through problems. I'd plan a session, plan what I was going to say, what they were going to say, you know, and the reality is that I never really knew. So my perspective now is to be open-hearted with people and not know what's going to happen, not know what they're going to say or what they're going to bring, but be available to respond to what they bring. So I feel before a session, I'm empty and available to respond.
That's great. No, would you say this is a new type of psychotherapy, this type of way?
I think it is. I think I haven't come across anybody that would recommend doing it this way, but I know it absolutely works.
That's very exciting. So you drop in, you feel the other person, and then you just respond from that.
Absolutely. And I see what they bring. And, you know, I've got to the stage, you know, with new people that I hardly want to read the file. I look at a referral letter, but if it's a good day, I'll just forget what it says and just let the client bring what they're bringing and, as I said, respond to that.
So what I want to say is, like, this is a revolution in psychology, in a sense.
Well, it feels like a revolution in the way that I work. I'm not sure I see myself as a clinical psychologist in that way. I remember when I qualified, I wasn't sure what a clinical psychologist was, but then knew that I was one because I just qualified. And I think people work differently. So when I'm in the room with someone, I'm not a clinical psychologist. I have my knowledge, I have my experience, and I'm a human being, and I'm connecting with another. And that's what it's about. So I don't wear my psychologist hat.
Well, the interesting thing, no, thank you. I've learned a whole other piece there, so I appreciate it. That. But another interesting aspect of your work, and I want to see how you integrate this, is working with people with Asperger's syndrome. Do you want to describe what Asperger's syndrome is, and then?
Sure. It's another aspect of my work, and really the main part, the focus of my work is to diagnose Asperger's syndrome. And in a nutshell, we're trying to find impairments in cognitive functioning in three main areas.
Wait, that's what Asperger's... are you going to describe what it is?
So, people... It's connected to the autistic spectrum, and people with these have difficulties in their social interactions, their communication skills, and their imagination. So they have impairments in those three, that triad of difficulties, and it affects how they function in the world.
So social skills, imagination, and communication. So, yeah, it does sound very autistic in a sense, but there's also supposedly some really intelligent people who have this as well.
I mean, it isn't to do with IQ. The whole IQ range is within the autistic spectrum, as the whole IQ range is in what we would call the normal population. So, in a way, we're categorizing people. And I have, although I've diagnosed many, many people, I have some uncomfortable around that, because there's part of me that doesn't really agree with that process, but I believe that by diagnosing them, it is helping them in some way fit into society.
Well, is there medication? What do you do for someone with this syndrome? And
I think the most important thing that I would support diagnosing someone with this condition is that it changes how other people think about the person with the condition. So it's important that people that are close to them or work with them or teach understand that they have particular difficulties that they need help and understanding with. So I'm not really into getting the person with the condition to change. It's more about accepting them as they are.
Well, how would someone with Asperger's syndrome actually show up? I mean, what kind of behavior would they exhibit?
Well, the different people are affected in different ways, so everybody's unique. As you know, everybody with Asperger's syndrome, it manifests in a unique way. So you can get variations. So some people can be very withdrawn, socially isolated, and not really wanting to interact with the world. Others are what's termed as socially active but unusual. And these people are sociable, but they kind of get the rules wrong, and they make mistakes all the time. So, for example, one that comes to mind was there was an 18-year-old that was told that he should ask someone for a comb if he wants to brush his hair. and he was on an escalator. He had a woman that he'd never met back home. Another man was told that to make friends, you should go to a pub and buy your friend a drink. So he went to the pub alone, and he bought everybody in the bar a drink. So it's kind of making social mistakes, and younger children, you know, they can be, some of them can behave in aggressive ways because they don't know any other way to behave, or you know, so it's basically getting social rules, not misunderstanding and doing things that are getting them into trouble.
But you know, there's, I think, a real danger in labels. I mean, I'm sure that you sort of suggested that, but it also seems to be a slight contradiction from what you said earlier, when you just sit down with people and talk from the heart as a human being, and now you've given them labels. I mean, how do you deal with that?
It's a good point, and it's and I guess a lot of my therapeutic work tends to be, because I've got different jobs, and it tends to be working with parents about their children, and accepting them and accepting their children. The kind of diagnostic work is, as you just said, it kind of feels like a separate piece of work, and I'm not sure if it's something that I want to continue with, but at the same time, I meet a lot of undiagnosed people with Asperger's syndrome that are in distress, and a diagnosis can make all the difference because people start treating them with care and understanding, which they weren't getting before. So that's the benefit of it. But it isn't as you just said. I mean, I've been doing this for a number of years, and it feels in conflict with how I'm wanting to work with people now.
I mean, you said there's really no cure and no treatment for this.
Well, that's not strictly true. I mean, there is intervention. But when you ask about cures, I mean, some parents, when their child receives a diagnosis, they really want to find a cure, and they all try different interventions. One of the things that's important, as I said earlier, for parents would be to accept their child as he is with his difficulties. So I met a man once that went on an intensive therapeutic treatment called Sunrise, and he was with his son 12 hours a day. And he said to me that before the treatment, he wanted to remove the autism from his son. As he worked intensely with his son, he got to know his son, and then he started to accept the autism as part of his son. And for him, that was a big shift. So as I said before, it was the parent that shifted in their understanding and not the child. And there are various interventions that are supposed to help. And some are successful. And I meet many people that have claimed success. But I tend to think the difficulties will always be there at some level. And what we have to do is, as I keep saying, is have acceptance.
So, I mean, once you have this acceptance, then it does seem like, it always seems like some cure is possible. It always seems like, you know, especially because you are so compassionate and empathetic, it seems like it would be possible for these people to have an awakening. Just like, you know, I sort of see them as the rest, like in comparison to the rest of the population, which is also unconscious and also basically antisocial. I mean, just look at the world. We're making wars. We're separating ourselves. We have an exaggerated emotion. We're sort of autistic as a race, in a sense. And people are shifting and waking up. So there must be something possible.
There's two things there. I think that once we have acceptance of everyone, including people with Asperger's syndrome, we will no longer need to diagnose them. It will become unnecessary. Part of the reason they come to me undiagnosed is because they're not being accepted in the world. And that's a big problem. And the second thing you said about a cure, again, you see, if we were going to think of a cure, then we have to think there's something wrong with these people, or that they have an illness or a disorder, although technically it is a disorder. But I think that, you know, is if they have a different perception and a different way of perceiving things and a different way of looking at the world. So they function in a different way than us. And if the majority of people, if over 50% of the population had Asperger's syndrome, then we would be the ones getting diagnosed with a condition, because all that there is in many cases is just a difference in operating and understanding.
So let's take this to a planetary level, right, where, how do you see, because we both work in the transformational world. We've just gotten back from a great week with Paul Lowe, who actually is retiring for those who are interested in that. But, you know, we see there's a great planetary shift. There's a polarity of consciousness happening. More and more people are waking up to this divine parts of themselves, and more people seem to be polarizing in that, you know, in this country especially, you know, where we have this really insane war, and where the government has lost touch with, you know, the needs of the people. I mean, Cheney actually says, I know it's an unpopular war, but it's something we have to do. It's like he's not realizing he's an elected official working for the people. There's something disturbed and also Asperger-ish about the U.S. government in the shape that it's in. So, I mean, how do we, if you were going to be a kind of global psychologist, what would you kind of diagnose and also prescribe for the planet as a population?
Well, in a general sense, for everybody.
Yeah. Well, in a general sense, you know, how are we, from your psychological background, going to make that change? Well, the planetary race, sorry.
I think change is already happening, and I think I was just connecting what you said and say a little bit more about the people with Asperger's, because what they have, I was thinking whether we need to help them change, because I can feel that in myself and other people we need to change. And what they often have, and I'm generalizing, but they don't focus or think very much about the past or the future. They're very in the here and now. They show little againstness towards people, and so there's a lot for us to learn from them. So on a global scale, for all of us, I think that as I touched on at the beginning, I think that we have to be taught to come from our hearts, and it has to start really with what we're teaching children, because we're getting that completely wrong. And what we're doing is developing their brain function, and we need to help them explore their emotional selves and their how they can come from the heart. And I think that, you know, when I say these things, they're just concepts, but we don't teach kids any of this stuff, you know, and we're obsessed with getting their brains to work better so they can pass the exams, and it just doesn't work. And so we have to explore that. And I also think that we have to learn from children and people with difficulties about how to be in the world. And it seems to me like things are upside down because the adults who, I think most of us I can't think of a better phrase to say that perhaps most or all of us are messed up in some way through our conditioning. And children, the younger the child, the less likely they are, and we have a lot to learn from them about how to be. And if you watch, you know, if you watch small children, 3-year-olds or 5-year-olds or 6-year-olds operate, you know, they are showing us how to be.
They're showing us how to be. So you're saying, and I think it's a great point, that instead of sending children to school to disconnect them, because it does, education disconnects them from their heart, their emotion, their feelings, that suddenly they're forced to remember things and to kind of disconnect from who they are. But it's like we're so stuck in this system. Do you see a new system developing that could really work with children and integrate education into emotions?
I think so. I think, you know, I almost feel like I want to say the best way to start would be to close every school for 6 weeks and start again, because to me, it is absolutely completely wrong. And I meet so many kids that are struggling in school or out of school and not going to school, and it is a very, very harsh place for kids. And it's totally wrong the way our schools operate and the expectations we put on kids and the values and what we say is important. And as long as we're doing that, we're just going to produce more kids that are going to become adults who are in turn going to do damaging things to kids.
Wow. I've heard this before, and I think it's always sounds like a radical idea, because we've been so conditioned to condition our children it would be great to shut the schools for 6 weeks, and what would you start with? What's your vision, if you can create a vision?
Well, it's so difficult because most adults believe in what they're doing, I meet many teachers that are under a lot of stress and a lot of pressure because they feel that they have to do it in a certain way, and it actually goes against their natural selves. So how we can turn this thing right around is really feels really difficult. And then I think, well, anything's possible. And I think that if, again, you know, people sense and know that things are damaging, and the teachers I know and speak to, many of them are not happy in what they're doing and how they're doing it. And so, it feels that what we have to do is give people the freedom to follow their hearts and do what they feel is instinctively right. Because what I'm getting is that it's not for me to tell people how to do it. It's for people to feel into their hearts and do it themselves. So people need to be free to operate from how they think or how they feel best.
I'm happy to hear you say that, and I also think that there's probably something impractical in a sense. I mean, it's idealistic, it's great, it's beautiful, it's visionary, but I mean, it almost seems impossible.
I think what I see and experience with my work with children and what goes on in schools is that I can see that it's not working. And my truth is, when I'm asked the question about what can we do about it, is that I don't know. And if I did know, I'd tell you. But I know what is happening isn't the way forward, and it can't go on.
Right. No, I get that. And also what I'm getting from you, or the sense that I do get from you, and it's like, you are, I mean, I'm just speaking of you because I feel, you know, I know you, and I feel like you are, your work is your compassion for other people, your empathy, your feeling for them. So what you're giving back to the world is the feeling and love, you know, and the empathy and the ability to feel what other people are feeling, and in a sense, that's all you can do on some level, and it's actually very beautiful and a great example.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that's occurred to me over the years that I've been working is that I don't think I've come across anyone that doesn't buy the concept that of punishment and bad behavior, and bad behavior should be punished. And people seem to think that on one level or another, and people debate about what kind of punishments we should have, whether they're very mild or severe, and what is bad behavior and naughty behavior and what isn't. But for me, you know, that whole concept of thinking is so unhelpful, because what we do is we look at a child's behavior and we view it in that duality of whether it's good or bad, and we give the child rules about whether they're good or bad. So a child grows up with this concept, and actually it doesn't make any sense. And I've seen parent after parent that have asked me for techniques about how they can better control their child, and they've tried all sorts of punishments, and what they found is that that things don't work. And I think that what we have to understand is that we are not able to make another human being do something they don't want to do. And I think if we can accept that, then we can operate from a different place.
I get that, and I also know, because I've been around children, and that they're very independent, and they, I was like that, you know. It's like I didn't like following rules and fitting in, and I think that's probably a natural way to be. And people like, many people like Robert Bly have said, you know, here's this child arriving with the power of the universe, and all a parent can say to them is be a good child. I mean, that is such a limitation.
And what they need to hear from parents is a message that says, not be a good child, be who you are, and let the child express themselves in their natural way. So if you've got a child that's very active and needs to be outside, then let that child go outside. And what we tend to do is we try and control them and tell them they have to go against their natural instincts, and then we end up diagnosing them with conditions such as ADHD, giving them medication, and trying to make them different from who they are. And you know, every child should be free to express their natural self in whatever way is appropriate for them.
Mm. That's good. So, like we've talked about, the ADHD or attention deficit disorder is a fabrication, I think, by a culture that doesn't know how to control probably these new children that are arriving with this new energy. Would you say?
Yeah, it's interesting whether there are children arriving with a new energy or whether they are responding to the negative energy that they're in. I don't know what the answer is to that. But what I do know is that, you know, again, it's a concept, and I talked about Asperger's syndrome, which I kind of believe as a condition. But when we look at attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, ADHD, I'm not sure about that. And I meet many children who are suspected already diagnosed with ADHD, and they come from places of distress and difficulty. Many of them are in homes where there's a lot of tension and anxiety and conflict. And of course, what some people will say is that the children are the cause of that. And then, you know, and then it's a chicken and egg situation. And obviously, you know, some children are affected by their diet. It's a controversial diagnosis, and in my view, it doesn't help anyone when we diagnose a child with a condition like that and give them medication and explain all their behaviour away as them having something wrong with them, I don't think it's a good experience for that child.
Well, the awful thing about that then is also to give them drugs that will actually distort or limit or shut down a part. I mean, I think that's an awful, awful thing to give a child who's just acting out drugs to control them because their parents can be in control. What's your experience with drugging children and how to deal with parents about that?
But it depends who the parent sees, and it can fit into their belief system. So I met a 14-year-old who had been on Ritalin for 9 years, and it's only recommended that he would be on it for 2. And so I think he began it when he was 5. And that experience was awful for him, you know, and he'd been teased at school, and, you know, and he had a very poor self-concept because he grew up with the belief that he had a condition that explained all his poor behavior. And when I looked at his background, you know, there was his father left when he was young, and then there was violent partners that lived in the home, two different ones, you know, and he had a tough
That's okay. No, I understand. I'll continue because that's fine. That's fine.
So, and the belief system in our culture, in the UK, is that the parent was told, given this as an explanation, so fully believed it. And what I'm saying is that if we have that concept and we give that to parents and children, then they're going to grow up and thinking about things in that particular way, which I think is unhelpful. And we could think about a child's behaviour, as I said earlier, in a different way and arrive at a different explanation for that child's behaviour that will be more helpful to the child and more helpful to the parents and make change more possible.
Mm. So, I don't know, it's just such a shock. It must be such a shock then to see these children after they've been giving Ritalin and to see the potential that's been zapped in them. I mean, well, how do you deal with the actual child themselves?
Well, I think, as I said earlier, there are a lot of my work is with parents, sometimes with children. I mean, the younger the child, the more likely I'm working with the parents, because I believe that that's the best way of helping the child. If I see someone like that, where I feel they've been squashed and suppressed by it, by our culture and how people are thinking about them, I will, as I said at the beginning, be accepting of them as they are. I will challenge their beliefs. I will challenge their beliefs about what other people believe about them. I will, put things in a different way with them and their parents, and it all depends really on how open and responsive the other people that or the child or the parents or anyone else involved are, and sometimes people are responsive and change happens and sometimes not, and that's why what I've learned is that I'm not trying to impose my ideas on people. I'm responding to what people bring. So if I see a family where they've lived with ADHD for 5 years and is part of who they see they are, then I'm not going to challenge that straight away. I'm going to work with what I've got and with what they bring. I'm going to do what's appropriate to respond to where they are. So that's why my work with each person varies from person to person, depending on where they're coming from.
Oh, thanks. Thanks, Mike. I didn't catch the last part of that. Cause, yeah, okay. Well,
I respond to where people are coming from.
Okay. No, I get that, and I think you have a really great overview of the educational system, and so as we kind of just one more area of discussion that I think we've been discussing, and I don't quite know how to fit it in, but we've been looking at alternate realities, and the name of the program is New Realities. So you've just given a very academic, very practical, psychological, and spiritual perspective, but then we know that reality is much bigger and more expansive. We've had experiences, me, you, and a bunch of other people, that say there's more. This whole radio show is called New Realities because I know, that there's a much bigger picture going on that we've been really sheltered from. So, we need to be re-educated about the nature of reality. I mean, how do we open up as a planetary race, as children ourselves, to the possibility that there's so much more? If you take this, psychological background and a spiritual perspective, because that's what my search has been in creating this program and other programs, how do we start to educate people and myself about the possibility that there are other and new realities? From if you can take the model that you put in and just expand it out, could you talk about that?
Well, I think that what needs to happen, and what I'd like to see happen, is that we would come together, people that have had these experiences and are open to seeing that there is possible to live in a different reality, and then we become examples of this, and then we can invite other people that have no experience of this to live with us for a while, or we could have we could have a child center where children with difficulties would come for a while. And I think that it has to be shared on a practical day-to-day level, so that people experience us as people. And I think that in my work, I try and do that in the clinic room, but it's not actually they're experiencing me for that hour in the way that I want to be, but they're not really feeling me fully as a human being, because it's about. So what I think is that we have to be examples and live with people that are like us, and also people that are unlike us.
No, I like what you said there, but there's what great teachers and great teachings say is live in the unknown. I love that line in Alice in Wonderland where the Red Queen says to Alice, "I like to believe six impossible things before breakfast." We are taught to be logical. This goes back to the education. We're taught to think logically with our mind, disconnect from the heart, ignore intuition and experience. This is educated out of us. And now, as we move into this greater possibility, we've understood, yes, feel with your heart, access your intuition. Your intuition is the key to a greater experience. And how do we bring that back as an educational program to schools and to the culture at large? I mean, you might not have thought about this before, but because you have thought about education, I'm just curious. Just take a stab at it.
What I get from that is that what clearly doesn't work is telling the other people how they need to live. So what if I start saying how I think it should be, then I'm setting up my rules and my ideas, and I know that it's just another person doing that, and it doesn't work. So the only way I can see around this is be responsible for how I live and be an example myself of how things can be different. So my focus needs to be on my reality, what's in front of me and who's in front of me, and how I communicate and with everyone, and as I said, from a heartfelt place in the here and now, and that's all I can do, and whatever comes my way, I'll respond to, or I intend to respond to in that way. And beyond that, so I'm seeing myself as being able and as possible for me to expand and include everyone in my life and to expand further, and so to come up with ideas or to say how we should live or how we should be feels wrong to me, and we've been doing that for thousands of years and it hasn't worked.
Right, we've been doing, it's just led us down a kind of negative path, or a path that seems to lead to a disconnection between who we really are. And what we're trying to do is reconnect.
Because all you're doing, if you start telling people what they need to do, is you're communicating with their minds. And again, and they either believe you or they don't, or they go for it or they don't. And then there'll be people that oppose it, and it's all mind stuff, and it's all more arguing and disputing and trying to make it better. And it just doesn't work that way.
Right. So another key here, and we're just coming to the end of the conversation at some point soon. Another key here, I think, and what I look for in new realities, is what Heraclitus said, is that he said, expect the unexpected, because it is difficult and hard to find, meaning that we are so conditioned to believe that reality is just one particular way. And if something comes along that's outside that box, it's actually shocking, frightening. It's traumatizing. We've been it's full of a traumatic disconnect, cognitive. I mean, this whole aspect that when something comes into view, how do we train ourselves to do what Heraclitus said: expect the unexpected.
Well, my take on that is that it's about paying attention to whatever's happening right now, and We don't know what's going to happen, and so when we're paying attention to what's happening right now, we're always ready for the unexpected, and we just don't know what's going to happen next. But that's where our attention needs to be, and that's where our response needs to be. So it's not really about planning or having ideas. It's about paying attention to whoever's in your reality, what they're saying in every situation. So you don't know what anything means. And I felt drawn to come with Alan to LA, and I thought, I wonder why I'm going. And today I met someone in a shop, and somehow we started talking about trauma victims, and she's from Bosnia, and she's been over here for 12 years, and she said, if you want to go and work with trauma victims in Bosnia, I have a place and you can go and stay. And perhaps my reason for coming to LA was for that conversation. How do I know? And I think in my mind it was to see Alan and do things with him. So I paid attention in that shop to what she was saying, and we swapped email addresses, and I think that may happen. I'm not saying it's going to happen. I don't know what's going to happen, but I'm open to it as a possibility.
Yeah, I think that's a great way of looking at reality, and it's something that our friend Paul Lowe talks about. Just be present with whatever it is, you know, whatever is in this present moment, whatever you're feeling, whatever's around you, whoever, whatever's going on for you right now, be, as Bashar, another teacher, says, just be the perceiver. Just perceive reality without judging it as right or wrong or good or bad. And when we do that, I think we can be ready for anything and everything. The walls that we put up around the reality that we like to live in are formed by our preconceptions and the way we think things are. So when we're open to these synchronicities, you run into this person in the shop, and, you know, who knows where that leads, we see that reality is much more interconnected and bigger than the small mind, the physical mind, the limited mind can perceive. So we have to somehow break out of the conditioning. I think what you said earlier, living from the heart space, opening up to bigger possibilities, but coming back to the present moment and living from the present moment creates a reality that where anything is possible. So if some being, we can be a little out there, walks through a wall, it's like, oh, that's interesting.
And what I get from that is that, you know, is a variation of something that Paul O says, is that nothing in what happens to us, nothing is more important than anything else, and nothing is less important than anything else. So you don't know when you're in your interactions, you know, if don't put any value on any kind of interaction you have with anyone.
Don't put any value on any interactions that you have with anyone. Now, just coming full circle then, how do you bring this back around to dealing psychologically with people that come to see you about complaints and situations and children that are hyperactive and Asperger's that seem to not be able to function within the society? I'm just trying to wrap it up here and see if we can connect it to the bigger picture. Does that make sense?
Well, when I see people now, I'm really in that space of not knowing when I'm in a waiting room. I don't know who I'm going to go in the room. I don't know when we're in the room. We might split up after 5 minutes. So I'm responding. And with the people with Asperger's, I mean, you know, it just goes back to, accept. It's funny, isn't it? Because what I say is accept them as they are. And at the same time, I diagnose them so people can see them as different. And it kind of doesn't make sense, but it kind of works because they're not accepted as they are. When they're undiagnosed, they're certainly not accepted as they are. And so the diagnosis helps to facilitate people accepting them as they are. And I can do that without diagnosing them. And as I said before, one day then that will be not necessary.
But going back to what you just said about living in the moment and being, is it a way to communicate that to the people with Asperger's so they can just live like normal people?
when you say live like normal people, my experience of people with Asperger's syndrome is that they're more in the moment than anybody else. So if I want to be, you know, if I'm trying to be in the moment, they're already there, mostly. So they're experiencing exactly what's going on. You know, this is a generalization, but they're experiencing exactly what's going on right now. So they don't, so we can meet them in the moment. We don't have to get them to be in the moment. They already are.
Could they then, and we talked about this earlier, could they actually be an evolution of the human potential? Like, they are already living in a sort of new society that we are hoping to evolve into, or is there something off still?
It's a very interesting question, and I don't know. And because they seem to lack some of the things that we have, like empathy and being able to think about the emotional states of other people. So that seems to be, I was going to use the word, a handicap for them in functioning with us. But it's really difficult because, you know, because they, as I said before, they don't show any againstness, so they have an acceptance of things and people as they are. So I think that so I don't know what the answer to that is. I don't feel that they're a model for how we should be, but I don't think we're a model for how we should be either.
I think so. The one part I don't get, and we're just about wrapping up here, but they don't have the capacity to feel emotions, Asperger's, or to feel other people's emotions. I don't quite get it.
Well, it varies, but there seems to be, they don't seem to have the same thermal control as us. So some of them don't seem to not feel very much, and some of them feel too much. So they can be like a tap that's full on. So the way that they control and manage emotions is different, and the way that they understand emotional states in other people is different. So a younger child might not understand that their mum is angry until she's shouting, and then be confused even why is their mum shouting at them. You know, so it is quite complex in that way, because, you know, they have a different way of perceiving the world and functioning in the world.
Mm. Right. Now, it's an interesting point. So they just are sort of a different race. We're talking about people with Asperger's syndrome. And talking to Dr. Mike Lockham from England. He's a clinical psychologist, and he's been really giving us an overview of a kind of new evolved psychology, I think, one that can be integrated into a bigger system, one that's based on feeling and presence and dealing with people as they are. It's been a really beautiful, heartfelt interview. I really appreciate all that you shared. Is there any closing ideas about anything that you've said here that you'd like to leave people with, and also perhaps, you know, information about yourself? So anything comes to just wrap up.
The only thing that comes when we talk about being, you know, from a heartfelt place, obviously when you're responding to where other people are, so it's feeding into where someone is, so often, you know, there's a lot of frustration and tension in the room, and I just share what I'm feeling. So the message I have, I guess, for myself is to be who I am in each moment and to share that. So if I'm feeling some negative emotion in the room with people, I'll share that. And that. So it's not just about being a positive role model. It's about just genuinely being who you are and sharing what's going on. People can email me at my email address is mike@jlarkham, which is L for Lima, A for Apple, R for Robert, C for Charlie, O for Amiga, M for Mike, B for Bravo, and E for Echo, and then it's .wannado, WANADOO.co.uk.
Thank you very much, Mike. I've been talking to Mike Lachlan. Lachlan. What is it, Mike? Sorry,
what's your last name?
How do you? L-A-R-C-O-M-B-E, and he's from England, and I welcome comments about this interview and others that you've heard on New Realities. If you want to reach me, I am at newrealities@earthlink.net, and my website is also newrealities.tv. I've been broadcasting pretty much on bbsradio.com for the last, I'd say, 2 months, and there's a whole bunch of great archive interviews available. If you go to the archives at bbsradio.com, go to New Realities, go to Archives, and then hit New Realities. I've done some shows recently about orphanages and care in Nepal and water rights around the world, and with a person, William Marks, and also talks about tribes in Africa, about certain contacts there. Well, last week was Kira K was handswithhands.org charity, and each week I try to have the most interesting and exciting guests that I think are really at the cutting edge of understanding a new way of living on the planet. So my name is Alan Steinfeld, and I really welcome comments. Please email me newrealities@earthlink.net, and any ideas for upcoming guests or any types of new shows or new possibilities. I might be interviewing Stanton Friedman, who's also, this is another theme of the show, which has been UFOs and UFO explorations. I just got back from UFO Expo in San Jose, which I'll report a little bit more about next week. So, because next week I will be interviewing Stephen Bassett, who is putting on the Exopolitics conference in Washington, D.C., September 16th and 17th. So, for more information about that, also email me whenever you feel inspired. Thank you for listening tonight. I'm going to end with a song by one of my favorite people, Deepa Pamal, and it is the Gayatri Mantra. And the Gayatri Mantra is a great mantra to just contemplate and help you enter an altered state. It's the mantra to Ganesh, which is who's the remover of obstacles. So just let the words in, open up, shift to new consciousness, and be aware of new realities. Thank you for listening tonight. It's the mantra to Ganesh, which is the removal of